This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. With 43 primaries and caucuses now completed, and Mitt Romney looking like the presumptive Republican nominee after a five-state sweep on Tuesday, voters will soon shift their attention to the fall general election matchup with President Obama. But for many Granite State voters, this election feels decidedly different than past primaries, a Republican horse race driven mainly by televised presidential debates, sporadic visits by many of the leading candidates, a television ad war fueled by millions in unregulated super PAC money, have all raised questions about the future of the presidential selection process. In addition, with the provision of political information increasingly dominated by smartphone apps, digital media, and social networking sites, we may be witnessing a fundamental transformation in how campaigns and voters make political decisions. Today on The Exchange, assessing the presidential selection process, let's hear from you. Has the presidential election season felt different to you? Are you concerned that New Hampshire's long tradition of retail politics is in danger of becoming obsolete? What was your experience with the New Hampshire primary this year, and what are your biggest concerns for the future? Call in. The Exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, and you can post our comments on our Facebook page. I have three guests joining me for the program today. Joining me in studio is Dante Scala, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of New Hampshire and a faculty fellow at the Carsey Institute. You can follow Dante on Twitter at GraniteProf. Dante, good to see you as always.
Good morning.
Joining me on the line from Des Moines, Iowa is Iowa Public Radio News Director Jonathan Aull. Jonathan, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Dean.
And joining me by phone from Washington, D.C. is Jack Gillum, Associated Press investigative reporter who focuses on money and politics. Jack, welcome to The Exchange.
Good to be here.
Dante, let me begin with you. As a veteran political observer in the Granite State, what's your gut-level sense about this election cycle? Was the New Hampshire primary really different this time around?
You know, the primary did feel different in the sense that nothing ever really happened. If you took a look at the polls a year out, before the primary, you probably would have had a pretty good idea of who was going to win the primary. Mitt Romney was ahead a year out, and he did very well, obviously, the night of the primary. And so for that whole year, it was unusual in the sense that usually we're waiting for something to happen, but usually something does happen. This time around, you know, there was a small boomlet for Newt Gingrich around Thanksgiving when the New Hampshire Union leader gave its endorsement. There was thought that Santorum might make a run post-Iowa, but really it was a lot of sitting around and waiting, and no candidate really tried to challenge Romney in terms of his organization on the ground in New Hampshire. I mean, Santorum spent a lot of time here but didn't have the money. Gingrich got a lot of hype but never really built an organization to match that hype. So it was a lot of kind of sitting around and waiting and watching on TV where all the action seemed to be as opposed to here in New Hampshire.
Yeah, Jonathan Aull, what about the Iowa caucus this time around? Did it feel different to you out there?
Well, it did, but you know, you can spin a narrative to make the case that either it was very different or that it wasn't. And we had a very different experience than New Hampshire.
Right.
If you take the time from just before the Ames straw poll through the Iowa caucus, the top six people, the people who would end up being the top six finishers, all spent time as the front runner in the polls. So in that respect, it bolsters this idea that anything can happen in Iowa, and it's really important, and retail politics is important, and that everybody got a fair shake. On the other hand, yes, a lot of the action was at the national level. But some of that in those national debates did take place in Iowa. So was that a national thing or was it an Iowa thing? Mitt Romney spent a lot of money, didn't spend a lot of time. Rick Santorum spent a lot of time, but didn't have any money. And those two essentially finished in a dead heat for first.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So, you know, what narrative do you want? Because I think you could spin either one, that either it was vastly different or that it was rather typical.
Did you hear anything in particular from voters, any kind of complaints about the lack of retail politics or the nationalization out there? I mean, what was the sense of voters on the ground?
Well, I think that you know, like in New Hampshire, the Iowa voters want to look every one of the candidates in the eye at a house party or a pizza restaurant, and there was definitely less of that this time. Although, you know, there was also some candidates realizing that that wasn't working. I think that one of the subtexts that may have been lost was that, you know, Tim Pawlenty from a neighboring state spent more time in Iowa than anybody leading up to the Ames straw poll, and he just got clobbered. And he realized that even with doing an immense amount of work of retail politics, that this wasn't his time, and he dropped out very, very early. So, you know, had someone with that kind of philosophy stayed in towards, you know, longer, it might have had an impetus to have more retail politics. So, yes, it was a little bit unusual, but it's not like people had no access to the candidates.
Right. Jack, how about the national view from Washington, D.C.? What's your sense of how this may have differed from the last election cycle?
Well, I think the big thing is that we've seen is the inordinate amount of money that has come in from a lot of these outside groups. You know, we look at the case of Iowa and the amount of money that, say, Restore a Future, I want to say at least $2.5 million, that is the super PAC that supports Mitt Romney's candidacy, had spent there, and how it clobbered Newt Gingrich. Not so much in New Hampshire, but the other places that they have spent money. I think where we look at it is what these groups are going to do. At least that's where I look at it from the vantage point of campaign finance. Mm-hmm. And we sort of try to, you know, read the tea leaves and say, you know, if a Las Vegas billionaire is going to give $10 million, $20 million to Newt Gingrich's candidacy, what does that mean? What if a Wyoming billionaire, Foster Freeze, decides to not give any more money to Rick Santorum, or rather the super PAC supporting his White House bid? At least from where I see it, I think that is what makes this race particularly different, particularly when you have the advent of super PACs after really this presidential election, the first that we've seen it really explode.
Right. And we're going to talk a bit more about super PACs later in the show. So, I mean, your sense is that the outsized influence of these individual donors was one of the biggest differences that you saw compared to 2008.
I would. And I mean, in 2008 we've sort of talked about it a little bit, I think is remarkably different. I mean, maybe if anything, the best comparison is 2004, when you had an incumbent president at times facing an uncertain future. In 2008, you obviously had the fervor and excitement surrounding Obama and Hillary, particularly when you look in the Republican side, and the fervor of Sarah Palin and that excitement that it brought to the GOP landscape. I think it's just this time trying to coalesce around a Republican candidate, and sure, we can talk about that more later in terms of the money that's coalesced, but sort of how one candidate doesn't really have to spend money on a primary race, while at 1.6, you know, a half a dozen of them were, and I think it's anybody's guess going forward about how that's really going to change things.
Dante, you wanted to jump in here?
Yeah, I mean, super PACs do kind of put a new wrinkle into the process, in the sense that, you know, it's become kind of mainstream political science thought that party elites now largely have control over the nomination process. Yes, voters get to vote in primaries and caucuses, but party elites in the year before Iowa and New Hampshire coordinate around a candidate, funnel money, resources, expertise toward one candidate in particular. If super PACs continue into, say, 2016, well, the new wrinkle is all of a sudden a candidate doesn't need to coordinate the resources of thousands and thousands of donors giving, say, a couple $1,000s apiece. They could cultivate a relationship with one or two, you know, billionaire donors and still remain important in the contest. And we saw that with Newt Gingrich, and we saw that with Rick Santorum.
Right. Dante, continue on a second. I wanted to talk about this unusual phenomenon we saw this time around of sporadic visits. You may remember back in the fall of 2011 here in New Hampshire, we had this interesting scenario of, I think it was Michelle Bachmann saying that New Hampshire was going to be a priority, and then she vanished for a month, and then other candidates said New Hampshire would be their priority and didn't show up for weeks at a time. Can you say a little bit about that? We hadn't seen that before.
Yeah, it was a sense, you know, people would stop by and visit, but then candidates wouldn't call, candidates wouldn't write for weeks and months afterward. And it's, you know, it's hard, again, it's hard to say whether this is going to be a trend or whether it was an aberration, because I think a lot of candidates ran into this fact that Mitt Romney was a very familiar face and a very well-liked face to New Hampshire Republicans. Romney had run here once before. He had built up good name recognition. He had a strong organization, and he fit the New Hampshire electorate in a way that, say, a Michelle Bachmann or a Rick Perry did not. So I think in order to see whether this is a trend, you have to look at an election like, say, maybe 2016, in which maybe there isn't a New England Republican running, and see what candidates do in that situation. But I think this time around, a lot of candidates felt as if things were stacked against them here in New Hampshire, and he can't blame them for thinking so. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, Rick Santorum seemed to basically set up shop in Iowa. He mentioned he visited something like 100. You have the pizzeria chain in Iowa that he spent a lot of time in, and we know all
pizza
about
ranch.
Pizza Ranch, right? And we know all about his pickup truck that he spent a lot of time in. What else? Who else out there kind of set up shop in a similar way? You know, typically the way we would think of, say, a John McCain in New Hampshire.
Well, really, it was Santorum, Pawlenty until he dropped out, and then Michelle Bachmann until after the straw poll, and she kind of thought that that she'd locked up Iowa and then tried to move on, when she really probably should have spent more time doing a victory lap and enforcing the gains that she'd gotten in the straw poll. But and Ron Paul spent a lot of time in Iowa as well, so. Yes, it might have been less than in the past, but you know, if you want to look at how things were different this time, I think the case study, at least from Iowa's perspective, is Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was a horrible, horrible campaigner in Iowa. I distinctly remember one of his few appearances in Iowa. I saw him at the state fair. Really just lecturing this couple on Sarbanes-Oxley, which is not really something that works in retail politics. He really didn't do well at all, but he got a name through the national debates, and he had a lot of money, but then money took him down as well. And, you know, so it's a really mixed bag.
We're going to take a quick break now. Coming up, we'll talk more about retail politics. We'll talk about campaign finance, talk a bit about new social media. We'll take your calls, so please stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from you, our members. Support also comes to us from Antioch University, New England in Keene, educating practitioner scholars with its doctoral program in clinical psychology. Information at antiochne.edu. And Granite Investment Advisors, providing long-term active investment management, now introducing a locally managed mutual fund option for long-term value investors. 888-442-9893. More on assessing the presidential selection process on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather today, becoming partly sunny across most of the state, mostly cloudy, a few showers for the North Country, windy statewide. Highs today in the 40s in the North Country, ranging to mid to upper 50s for the rest of the state. Tonight, partly cloudy on the chilly side, lows near 25 from the White Mountains north, around 30 in central areas of the state, 30 to 34 degrees in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis from SNHU, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, we're assessing the presidential selection process. After a long campaign season of caucuses and primaries, attack ads, and super PACs, many have noticed significant changes, more debates, an explosion in the use of digital media, and a decline of retail politics. But is this a troubling trend or the new reality for choosing a president? You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email The Exchange, exchange@nhpr.org. Has the presidential election season felt different to you? Are you concerned that New Hampshire's long tradition of retail politics is in danger of becoming obsolete? What was your experience with the New Hampshire primary this year, and what are your biggest concerns for the future? Call in and let us know. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And I want to continue on talking about retail politics a little bit more. Dante, we've had a mention of Tim Pawlenty, who, my recollection, was here as early as December of 2009, giving a county Republican talk. What do you think happened with Pawlenty here in New Hampshire?
Well, you know, Tim Pawlenty was on the right track in New Hampshire. I think the Pawlenty campaign was a case study in being caught flat-footed again and again and taking the wrong lessons from 2012 again and again. And again, it's easier said than done, right? I mean, it's easier to look back in retrospect and say Pelosi did all the wrong things. It's another thing when you're in the midst of a campaign trying to figure out what to do. But arguably, you know, Pelosi won, built up to a debate moment back in June of 2011.
This is the famous Romney moment where he pulled back. Go ahead, you can talk about it.
Exactly. I mean, there was a time in which Pelosi looked as if he was going to challenge Romney on health care and the similarities of Romney's health care plan in Massachusetts to President Obama's health care plan. They built to this moment, and then in a New Hampshire debate, the moderator challenged Pelosi to basically make his charges against Romney face-to-face. Pelosi declined, and the national media basically threw up their hands and said, ah, Pelosi's done. And so there was that debate moment. Also, I think the other thing was investing all that time into Ames and then not getting much payoff from it, but then getting out. And maybe some more patience for Pelosi would have paid off, especially given the fact that someone like Newt Gingrich, who was doing so poorly, managed to resurrect himself. Why not Pelosi at some point down the road?
It certainly seemed like Pelosi was following the traditional script where if you don't do well initially, you get out. And this and it seems like those rules didn't really apply this time around. So we're talking about these debates. I lost count after about 20 of them. But my sense is they brought in huge television audiences. Millions of people were watching these, which was a good thing for the cable networks and the network television. Jack Gillum, your thoughts on the debates. What was your sense? Were there too many of them this time around? Do you think they served a useful purpose for voters? Or was it just turned out to be a lot of kind of noise?
Well, I mean, I certainly know that when we talk to readers and maybe even some, you know, some folks here in Washington, I know that there was that sense of, oh, gee, turn on the television. You know, I really wanted to watch my favorite program or something, and now I'm seeing a debate. I think, you know, the opposite of that is that the more that these candidates are out there, and albeit a lot have said, oh, well, it's a scripted affair, is that the more these candidates are out there, the more that people have a chance to ask them questions. And perhaps that's where that's my my bias or my hobby horse is being able to ask these candidates as many questions as they can. I think that every time that they go up there on stage, there's certainly things that we can, you know, take a look at and fact check. And I know we do that at the AP fairly regularly with what candidates say. One thing that comes to mind is when I was watching one of the earlier debates with Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, she made some comment about how President Barack Obama's approval ratings were some of the lowest ever, I believe, in this part of the 20th century. And we went back and looked at the Gallup poll, of course, and found, yes, that's true, except if you exclude Richard Nixon, Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, and the list goes on. So I do think that while, yes, there may be a little bit of voter fatigue, I mean, I personally like seeing as many of these things as I can, but probably to the chagrin of my editors who say, no, that's enough, we need to go home now. But I think the more chances that viewers and readers really have a chance to see what these people have to say, I think it's the better. But that's just my take on it.
Jonathan, we love the debates here in New Hampshire. I'm someone who has said over the years that they should figure out ways to kind of trim the field down earlier on in the process so you don't have 11 people on stage. I get a lot of pushback from people who think that would be non-democratic. You've had a couple debates out there in Iowa. What's your sense of how they fit into the process this time?
Well, I agree with Jack that the more the better, because there isn't a requirement for any engaged voter to watch all of them. They're a resource for voters out there. I think that if you're going to criticize the debates at all, it's more likely a valid one to criticize the way that they're covered in the media, that it's more about the next morning story of who gaffed more than it is finding out what they actually said about the issues. So, you know, I think that if we're really serious about having issue-based elections where voters get to get information and accumulate it on their own and then come to a decision, that the debates are fabulous and there should probably be more of them. And, you know, at some level, the more the merrier.
Okay, let's take a call, guys. Mike in Hillsborough is joining us. Mike, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, hi. I had come across this figure, correct me if I'm wrong, perhaps not surprisingly, something like 95% of the elections on the federal level, so this would be President, U.S. House, U.S. Senate, are won by the candidate that has the most money to spend, or actually spends the most money. So my take on that is that the Citizens United decision, Supreme Court, of a couple of years ago, has pretty much locked in the stranglehold that, big money, big corporations, big media have on the electoral process. The only chance we're going to have of getting a president or, other elected official that, truly represents the people's interests would be some kind of public financing of, important campaigns. Just want to get your panel's take on that. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Mike. Jack, why don't you take that? You spend a lot of time studying campaign finance.
Sure, and I don't think there's a week that goes by when I don't hear the phrase Citizens United, you know, either something that I mentioned because I'm late writing another story about it. And I do think the caller is right. I mean, I think in the sense that there is certainly a lot of money being poured into this election by a lot of outside groups. And to be clear, I mean, it wasn't just Citizens United, which really opened the doors for corporations and to spend money from their, treasury, from their, actual corporate treasuries. There are other cases like the Speech Now decision and a couple of others that in the last couple of years, as the caller mentioned, have sort of stripped away these prior restrictions on, when money could be given or when it could be spent and how much could be given. I mean, to be fair, and, you know, Republican operatives point this out and others too, I mean, you'd be surprised the across the aisle support and, you know, chagrin that these new rulings have. But they'll say things like, well, look at MoveOn.org and the millions that George Soros poured in 2004 to help get John Kerry elected. The difference, of course, is that those so-called 527 organizations regulated by the IRS had sort of this questionable legality, is one way to put it. I mean, there was this cloud hanging over them of whether it was real, if it was copacetic. But now it's pretty clear in 2010 that these entities, these super PACs that can spend unlimited amounts of money as long as they disclose their donors, is the way to go. I do think that disclosure caveat might raise some issues. One of them being that even, you know, how much disclosure is disclosure enough? We did a story on it about a few days ago when one of these groups, Restore Our Future, that supports Mitt Romney, had listed a clerical error, had listed the wrong address, and we found out that it was a completely different company that was really, in some ways, a hedge fund, I guess. And it really leaves voters in the dark sometimes, I think, about what. You know, do these people have any access to Grind? You know, and this goes for the group supporting President Barack Obama too. And I think that's the challenge here.
Jack, do you have any sense? Are you following Congress at all on the campaign finance issue? You know, my sense is that over the years we have this cycle of Congress legislating campaign finance reform, then it goes through the courts, and there's some sort of decision that shakes things up, and then the cycle starts all over again. Do you have a sense of where Congress is right now on this issue?
I think that they are certainly ready to leave this alone. I do know that, the Disclose Act, which would sort of chip away this obfuscation, I guess is what the critics would call it, in terms of people who give to 501c4 groups. They're like 501c3s, the nonprofits you normally hear of, only these are called social welfare organizations. Every super PAC has one of them, well, at least of the major ones. American Crossroads has Crossroads GPS. They can only spend, depend on who you ask, up to 50% on political spending, but they don't have to disclose their donors. And I know that there was a bill that went forward. I know Chris Van Hollen was very big on this, if I'm not mistaken, out of Maryland, to sort of chip away and make sure that there was transparency there. But I don't really see, at least from where I sit, a lot of movement on this. I certainly know that down the street at the FEC, they're, you know, I mean, they come to a gridlock even deciding what coordination is between a super PAC and a candidate, a 3-3 ruling which goes nowhere, and it can be pretty heated at times. So, in other words, I don't expect a major overhaul of the campaign finance system, but who's to say?
Dante, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, getting back to Mike's point about, you know, whether, you know, super PACs and Citizens United, you know, benefit, you know, is there any hope for underdogs? Well, at least in, you know, this 2012 Republican primary cycle, super PACs arguably, you know, did help the underdogs. You look at, you know, going into the race, it was, you know, who were the candidates with the big fundraising networks? Well, it wasn't Newt Gingrich, and it wasn't Rick Santorum. It was Mitt Romney and Rick Perry. And, you know, for a Rick Santorum especially, you know, someone who wasn't going to be able to build those large fundraising networks, if not for, you know, a benefactor like Foster Freeze, who was willing to throw in a lot of his own money, and the fact that he wasn't capped at just throwing in a couple of $2,000-$3,000, well, that lets Santorum have more of a voice in the primary cycle than arguably he otherwise would have, and was able to contest more primaries than he otherwise would have. So in a funny way, I mean, if you look at super PACs, they created more competition, at least in the primary cycle. Now, of course, Romney had his own super PACs, fair enough. But all in all, it did loosen up the monopoly Romney had on the purse strings of the Republican Party, it seems.
Jonathan, can you jump in a bit? We know that the Romney super PAC, Restore Our Future, Newt Gingrich was famously furious about the way he was attacked in Iowa. Could you tell our listeners about that a little bit?
Sure. And I think that what you saw was that when Gingrich started to rise up in the polls as the caucus neared and he had his brief flirtation with being the front runner, the Romney-supported PACs pulled out all the stops and just went after Gingrich like mad. And they covered the airwaves with attack ad after attack ad, and the Gingrich campaign was mostly caught flat-footed with an inability to respond. I think, though, that trying to say that Citizens United or the influence of super PACs will single-handedly change the shape of elections is a little bit misguided, and let me explain. I hate to use war analogies because war is such a serious thing, but you look at the Citizens United decision, and what it has allowed is more carpet bombing, is that now you have these super PACs that are able to come in and throw down a lot of money and do a lot of media, and that can knock someone like Gingrich or another candidate. It can really hurt them very badly. But you can't win a war without the ground forces to come in after it. And I think you can make the argument that the reason that that Gingrich was hurt so badly by this super PAC carpet bombing was because he had no organization in place in Iowa. He didn't have the ability to campaign very well. He wasn't good at retail politics, and that was the reason why he wasn't able to respond to it. You know, remember that Rick Santorum didn't have any money, didn't have much in the way of super PACs behind him in Iowa, but he still got a chance. He still got enough of attention that he had some momentum to at least get his message out in future primary states. So I think that you know, the money is a part of the equation. It may be becoming a bigger part of the equation, but I think to suggest that super PACs by themselves will be the be-all and end-all of any part of the campaign process, I don't agree with that yet.
And I think getting back to my initial comment to you, Dante, about this unusual kind of sporadic set of visits we had in the fall here, and that was that period where virtually every few weeks you had a new front runner. And I remember talking to you about the fact that it just seemed like the problem was that these candidates, as Jonathan was saying, did not have the grassroots infrastructure. They didn't put in the initial foundations for a grassroots campaign. So it was all kind of this media-driven type of success with nothing underneath it.
Yeah, and again, that gets back to the kind of one of the big questions. Was 2012 the start of a trend or just a fluke? I mean, you did have a series of candidates other than Mitt Romney who weren't exactly A-list candidates, as it turned out. I mean, Newt Gingrich, as we've said, had severe weaknesses. Rick Santorum had surprising strengths, but obviously weaknesses in fundraising and organization. Rick Perry looked on paper to be a perfect conservative rival to Mitt Romney, but as debates proved, he was unready, unfit for to be the nominee just yet. And Michelle Bachmann, and the list goes on. You know, candidate after candidate who were less than the complete package. And when things got tough, you know, if there was a debate gaffe or something like that, they just weren't in a position to weather the storm.
Jack, do you want to jump in? Any final thoughts on campaign finance?
Yeah, I will do a couple things, and I think they're right about this. And you know, in terms of the super PAC being the be all and end all, and you know, is it sort of will the walls come tumbling down? I mean, I tend to see that, you know, at this point, you're right. There's a difference between the carpet bombing and the ground operation, and then even though I work with the data and analysis a lot, I can't help but think anecdotally back to when I was home visiting family in Arizona around the time of the Arizona primary, And we were sitting on the couch watching TV, you know, with like the family dog, and we saw it within a span of 15 minutes, I could swear there were at least three Super PAC ads that came on. And my mother, you know, sort of in her, you know, sort of scoffs and goes, oh, here it is again. And then I sort of realized that this sort of goes along with what other Republican operatives have told me privately, at least the ones that run some of these Super PACs. And that's one thing that they are worried about is voter fatigue. And will this sort of markedly change thing? What their strategy going forward is? Is it, you know, direct mail? Is it in diversifying how they're going to get their message out is one thing, certainly. And let's also not forget that, you know, legally speaking and otherwise, these Super PACs can't give money to campaigns to, you know, help keep the lights on and help pay for staff. Sure, there's other ways around that system that I'm sure are yet to be exploited. But, I mean, those are the rules the way they are. So I think we'll really have a better understanding, a better hypothesis to make once we see the general election, if we see, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars coming in from big sugar daddy donors, then we'll have a better way to see it. So.
Campaign finance is a very big issue this time around. I just want to quickly remind our listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Dante, real quick before we have to go to another break, I want to go back. I had one final question on the debates. I'm starting to get the sense that these debates were almost, the debate performances were almost substituting as a proxy for viability in the general election. Do you think, in the primary election, do you think that's a problem, that essentially we started assessing whether these candidates were viable or electable simply based upon debates rather than on kind of grassroots politicking? Is that a fair criticism?
I think it's a fair statement that, I mean, I certainly in the case of Rick Perry, I think a lot of people looked at how he performed in those debates and said,
it's a good example.
No, he's not ready to be the nominee. You know, there's no way he can beat Barack Obama in a general election. And was that an unfair test? I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was that unfair a test, frankly. Now, certainly there were other cases where you could, you know, you saw this kind of flurry of judgments after these debates, which were the equivalent of, you know, figure skating judges. Like, well, Romney hit the wrong tone there. He sounded too much like a plutocrat, et cetera, et cetera. But I think debates gave millions of viewers a chance to have a front row seat that usually only we in New Hampshire and Iowa have.
Great, thanks. We're going to take one more quick break. Coming up, let's talk a little bit about social media. I'd be interested to hear what our reporters have to say about how they use that. And we'll also take your calls, so stay with us.
Nowadays, science and religion do daily battle.
The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown blew that battleground wide open.
Both vying to be that infallible source from which we draw our truth.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Join Dan and me at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on May 18th. Tickets and information for this special benefit for writers on the New England stage are at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Verus Wealth Partners, a sustainable wealth management firm dedicated to aligning investors' financial objectives with their mission and values. Values Wealth Sustainability, VerusWP.com. And from SIT Graduate Institute, putting passion into practice with internationally focused master's degree programs hosting an open house on May 4th. Information at SIT.edu. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Monday on The Exchange, we sit down with author and biologist E.O. Wilson to talk about his new book, The Social Conquest of Earth, in which he seeks to explain the human condition by chronicling major evolutionary events millions of years in the making. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us on Monday morning live at 9. Today, the presidential selection process. This year stands out from past elections. Join us with your questions and comments by calling in at 1-800-892-6477 or emailing us at exchange@nhpr.org. I have three guests with me today on the show. Dante Scala, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of New Hampshire, Jonathan Aull, news director from Iowa Public Radio, and Jack Gillum, Associated Press investigative reporter who focuses on money and politics. And gentlemen, I want to talk a little bit about digital media. I've done some reading on it. I have become a regular smartphone user myself. I've read that the biggest difference between 2008 and 2012 in terms of the presidential cycle is the mobile nature of information, the rise of smartphones, and the dominance of social networking, especially Facebook and Twitter. It's allowed what I like to call the rise of the instantaneous news cycle, and we've seen campaigns have these rapid response teams where you literally have tactical battles on Twitter and Facebook every day. Dante, you have been a blogger for many years. You've now started incorporating Twitter into your political analysis. Tell us a little bit about the pros and cons. I know you use it fairly regularly and you're a big proponent of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting on Facebook. You know, in my Facebook network, I tend to be Facebook friends with a large number of people who are interested in politics. And it was striking to me the contrast between the New Hampshire physical landscape, where things were kind of quiet in the campaign, and the kind of the New Hampshire's virtual campaign, because you certainly saw a lot of political activists in New Hampshire trying to get the message out for their candidates via their Facebook accounts. And so you could kind of track the fortunes of, say, one candidate or another in terms of how much play they were getting from these activists. Now, and in some ways, I think that started to take the place of things like the church supper, mm-hmm. Where people would reach out one-to-one with other voters and activists, and it became much more of a virtual thing. Now, all that said, though, it wasn't Newt Gingrich who vouched that he had found a whole new way of campaigning, including these social networks. It wasn't Gingrich who was able to figure out how to build a virtual organization and have it produce real votes. You know, it was Mitt Romney who had a virtual organization but also a real organization on the ground who wound up running a campaign that was heads and shoulders above Newt Gingrich's.
So in an odd way, I am now having a retail politics experience through my cell phone, essentially, where my kind of one-on-one interaction is through Twitter or maybe getting an email from a particular candidate. Jonathan Aull, as a news director in Iowa, I'm sure you have to pay a lot of attention to these new technologies. Say a little bit about how it's influenced your coverage of the presidential election and just in general your sense of how it's affecting the campaign.
Well, I think the way that it is making information a much more immediate, and all of our reporters follow every Twitter feed they can, and we definitely get story ideas, we get contact information that way. I don't know how much it's actually impacting the campaign, though, because, and this is just completely anecdotal, but how many undecided voters are really following people on Facebook or Twitter and taking the posts that are there and having that influence who they're going to vote for? I think that number is relatively small. Now, having said that, this is a way to energize your base. And that's where I think social media really does have an impact and will have an impact in the future, is not so much really being able to take an undecided voter and get them to decide, but rather appealing to everyone who's for a certain candidate, revving them up. You know, we're going to have a meetup at this place. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. You got to come out. So I think that's where it will have a real impact. And I think that it's part of the equation, and that's something that we've been talking about all hour, is all of these pieces, be it the focus on national debates, super PACs, social media. I think what it does is it makes the formula to getting elected have many more components and become more complicated. But in a way, it also makes every piece of them less important by themselves and more important into an integrated strategy. You can't win just with super PAC money. You can't win just with a great Twitter account. You can't win with just a great ground game. You need the right balance of all of them working together.
And I think that the ability to micro-target voters with this technology is quite remarkable, the ability to literally go to their cell phones. Jack, I've read that there's something like 100 million cell phones in this country. About one out of every three people has a cell phone. I remember you may not, but I remember the days when the AP, the Associated Press, ran the news ticker, and that's where you got your updated news on the big clunky machine. How has the digital technology and social media changed the way the AP tries to stay on top of the presidential campaign?
Well, it's funny that one of those old-fashioned ticker machines actually is sitting right over near my desk, and it's sort of and it has a printout from December 7th, 1941 still in it.
So they stopped as it's kind of a memorial to the old ticker?
You're right, it is, but I think, at least I can wax nostalgic quite often, and when I walk by it, I'll be fair. I've always been in this industry when we've had computers and, when we've had the internet, but at the same time, I think just as there's certain ways that Twitter and social media have impacted the presidential election, how we cover it, and I'm biased, but I do think the AP does a tremendously good job in terms of keeping on top of that. I mean, I think our iPad app alone is phenomenal. I mean, I sit and I catch up on stories I may have missed on the wire overnight. But I think the value that we add to readers, and I don't want to sound like I'm giving a sales pitch for the AP, but I think, when we do use social media, yes, it's important in terms of reporting. We see trends on Twitter, we see them on Facebook, we see what people are saying, and yes, that's important to make sure that we aren't tone deaf and that we also get good stories. But I also think that that's to juxtapose that against other good stories that we and others do that don't rely on social media, or dare I even say the internet. And a prime example of that is when I got a tip through, covering this election that Mitt Romney, while he was in charge of Bain Capital, had laid off some workers down in South Carolina, moved them to New Hampshire, and then laid them off, and I believe sent some jobs overseas. Now, this happened in the 1980s, when the internet was essentially the domain of the Department of Defense and some research institutions. It wasn't really, so when you would literally Google this company name, Holson Burns, it was the only time in my life, I think, when you on Google, it got zero results. And even through Nexus, it didn't. I mean, this took an effort of flying down to Gaffney, South Carolina, digging through a courthouse basement, and I don't know how many times I sneezed from all the dust I had to brush off of it, and pulling up these old clips on microfilm to boot, and found out that, yes, indeed, there was contemporaneous documentation that showed that this was the case. I bring that example up to say that while readers and politicians and everyone else and journalists are focused on social media, I think there's value that we as reporters can add to this, where you can't just Google it. You can't just, search a hashtag on Twitter to find a story. And I think it's that mix that makes for, it sort of helps explore the contours of a race like this one.
Dante, you wanted to jump in, and I also wanted to ask you from a political science perspective, is there any sense yet of how this is affecting voters? We've talked a lot about how campaigns use these types of social media, and Jonathan mentioned a little bit that perhaps it was not having the same kind of impact on undecided voters that we might think. What's your sense from kind of a voter decision-making perspective of whether or not this really matters?
I think we're starting to try to figure out some correlations between what happens on the internet, Google searches, for example, is the fact that a candidate is trending upward in terms of the number of people who do a Google search for him, say, after a debate, does that have any correlation to, a surge in popularity for a candidate down the road? And now the question is all of that just kind of much ado about nothing? And it's instantaneous, to be sure, but is it like a wave on the beach? Does it disappear as quickly as it showed up? I think is a question to look at. And again, it gets back to this bigger question about whether we're going to see virtual organizations replace, grassroots organizations in American politics. Because I think Jonathan could speak to this. Mm-hmm. One reason Mitt Romney did as well as he did in Iowa without the pressure of expectations was because he didn't have to build a large-scale organization in Iowa. He had a good enough computer database to reach out to, Romney voters from 4 years ago and stay in contact with them virtually as opposed to on the ground.
And as a precursor of this, you may remember about Barack Obama's vaunted email address list that they compiled during the 2008 election as giving them this unparalleled access to supporters. Jonathan, do you want to comment on that?
I do, and Dante makes a great point. But remember, the reason that Mitt Romney had that impressive database was because he had an immense ground game 4 years ago. So again, I think that it's the point. I maybe I'm hammering too much here. Is that it's the right mix of all of these things together, and that I think that any candidate that thinks any one of them is going to be the difference is not correct. You know, during the Iowa caucuses, probably the best ground game in Iowa was of Barack Obama, because while all of the Republicans were doing whatever they were doing, the Obama campaign, without a lot of fanfare or media coverage or spending a lot of money, was reinforcing all of their contact lists. They were having meetups and house parties, and they were building the ground game for the general election. So I think that the idea that retail politics, the idea that that our campaign, that retail politics are gone, or that all campaigns will be virtual, is simply not accurate. But I don't think you can ignore the virtual stuff, because that is a big part and is going to get bigger. But it's about finding all of those pieces and getting the gears to mesh between your money, your time, your virtual thing, your messaging, how you do in debates. And I think that it's just the equation is getting more complicated.
Yeah, and I think that's a balanced way of thinking about it here in New Hampshire as well. Dante, quick, do you have something you wanted to add on that?
Yeah, I think Jack's point about the kind of the media and reporting is well taken, because, I mean, so on Twitter, you can follow the feeds of these, you know, major league political reporters who are on the bus, say, with Mitt Romney going through New Hampshire. And so you can follow in real time what's going on with Mitt Romney. But, you know, after an hour or so of looking at Twitter feeds, you realize – not much is happening right on the bus with Mitt Romney. It's like, oh, look, Mitt Romney bought us all hoagies in Claremont, New Hampshire today. And so there's this sense in which, you know, there's a lot of tweeting, but not much traction, because there's just not that much news being generated on any campaign bus on any given day.
We only have a few minutes left. I wanted to get you all to speculate a little bit about the next, about the general election, but also about the next election cycle. You know, what aspects of this that we're seeing now, and I think, Jonathan, you did a nice job of kind of laying out all the components. You know, where is the emphasis going to be going forward in the general election and in 2016? Jack, why don't you jump in and give us your sense of the future?
Sure. I think the biggest thing for me is seeing where this money is going to shift around and where it's going to be spent. The president right now has, you know, just in this last month alone, more than $250 million that he's raised between he and the DNC. You have other groups that are now sort of starting to coalesce around Mitt Romney, and particularly their big donors. And this is just beyond super PACs. It's the amount of money that the DNC and the RNC, who just started raising with Mitt Romney, will be able to actually coordinate with these candidates. Will this be a $1 billion election? Possibly, we'll wait and see, but I think the advent of these super PACs, in addition to the already big amounts of money here, I think is going to make this a sight to see in terms of the airwaves.
Dante, do you want to give us a sense?
Yeah, and what I'm curious about is, you know, despite all this, is all of this money, you know, if this billion-dollar election and so forth, is going to be so much money spent on such a thin slice of the electorate? I mean, already we see that, you know, despite all of Mitt Romney's problems with conservative Republicans, 9 out of 10 Republicans already say, yes, I'm voting for Romney over Obama. 9 out of 10 Democrats say, I'm voting for Obama over Romney. So it's going to be interesting to see how all those massive amounts of money are funneled and directed at such tiny slices of the electorate to try to get somebody to 50% plus one of the vote.
And Jonathan, we'll have you wrap up with your thoughts in a moment. But I just wanted to mention, we had an email from Fergus in Wolfboro, and Fergus's argument is that it's the appealing nature of a candidate that really drives the influx of money, not the reverse. That money is a symptom and not the cause of support for candidates. So we just wanted to get that into the mix as well. Jonathan, your thoughts on what we have to look forward to?
I think as the equation gets more complicated, it will make it easier to be a flash in the pan and harder to close the deal. So my suspicion is 4 years from now, what you're going to see is twice as many people having some level of viability and coming up briefly and then flaming out, and it will be harder to close the deal, but it'll be a lot easier to get you know, a week's worth of attention as being a viable candidate for president. One other quick thing I wanted to throw in. Mike from Hillsborough called in about that 94% number.
Right.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, in 2010, the candidate who spent the most money won 85% of the House races, 83% of the Senate races, close to 94, but not exactly.
Dante, one final question that I just wanted to touch on real briefly. What does this mean for the political parties? You know, we talk about running for president as being a candidate-centered exercise. Have the political parties managed to kind of keep up with all this, or is this even kind of further take the whole candidate selection process away from the parties?
I think they're barely keeping up, political parties. I mean, I think there's a real question about, you know, you look back on, say, you know, the last two Republican presidential cycles, and arguably in both cases, a candidate who was a bit of a maverick wound up winning the nomination. You look back on John McCain in 2008 and then Mitt Romney in 2012, although he doesn't have a maverick's personality. Certainly there were a lot of conservatives who expressed a lot of doubt about a Romney candidacy, and yet, you know, Romney managed to win the nomination despite the fact that there wasn't a lot of gelling of party elites. And so you got to wonder, are party elites running scared a bit of what's going on at the grassroots?
I'm sure we're going to continue talking about this process of selecting the president in the months to come and in the general election, but we are out of time. I'd like to thank all three of our guests for joining us this morning. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
That's Jonathan Aull, news director for Iowa Public Radio. Jack, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you. Have a good weekend.
That's Jack Gillum, Associated Press investigative reporter who focuses on money and politics. And Dante, it's always great to talk politics with you.
You too, Dean.
That's Dante Scala, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of New Hampshire. He's a fellow at the Carsey Institute, and you can follow Dante on Twitter at GraniteProf. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.